disperse immediately or you will be subject to arrest. Do it now.
A boss ain't nothing but a thief on a time loan. 128 bit war, you play Nintendo on some shooter, so put the bridge down and feed us to the killer bees. We get what we deserve, life. Bury me with my MP3s. Write my manifesto in 72 DPI. Life's just a game, you got cheated, never learn. I write these songs every bridge that ain't been burned. For every cop car that ain't been.
Welcome. This is America, December 18th, 2020. On today's episode, we bring you a series of interviews. First up, we speak with somebody at the Red House in North Portland, which recently was at the center of a mass eviction blockade. While the interview took place before the barricades around the house came down, our interview discusses how the blockade can hopefully provide important lessons for future eviction defense campaigns. We then speak to two participants in the Certain Days Collective, which puts together the Certain Days Freedom for Political Prisoners yearly calendar, as well as It's Going Down's Prison Break column. We talk about political prisoners, repression in a post-rebellion world, and what a project like Certain Days means in 2021, and much more. Finally, we speak with activist, filmmaker, and journalist Eleanor Goldfield, the host of Act Out on Free Speech TV. We talk about Goldfield's career in grassroots journalism, as well as their new award-winning documentary film, Hard Road of Hope, which covers the current situation in Appalachia and in coal country. During our discussion, we talk about mountaintop removal, the opioid crisis, Trump, and the importance of the memory of working class resistance. All this and more, but first, let's get to the news. On November 29th, beloved anarchist and abolitionist Karen Smith, key organizer in solidarity with prison struggles in Florida, sadly passed away in a tragic car accident. Karen was a guest on the It's Going Down podcast numerous times. In early December, comrades marked her memory with a demonstration and noise demo outside of the Florida State Prison. In New Jersey and New York, the fight against ICE continues. The Bergen County Jail, ICE detainees have launched a hunger strike, and on the streets, people have rallied and marched in solidarity only to be attacked by the police. In Chicago, abolitionists place signs outside the local jail for every person trapped inside this COVID hotspot, it read. 8 prisoners have died this year due to the jail's willful negligence. In Vancouver, Washington, people continue to take to the streets for Kevin Peterson, who recently was shot and killed by law enforcement. Responding to a call by the Revolutionary Abolitionist Movement, or RAM, for a week of remembrance with slain Portland-area anti-fascist Michael Reinel, people in various cities across the so-called United States held vigils, put up posters, and dropped banners. In LA, Black Lives Matter continues to lead demonstrations attempting to block the appointment of Mayor Garcetti to Joe Biden's incoming cabinet, which has led to fights with police in the streets. Appalachians Against Pipelines reports that despite an injunction, the Yellow French Tree Sit continues full steam ahead, with tree sitters having defended the space for over 835 days and have been fighting the injunction for over a month. In Brooklyn, the Brownsville community continues to fight the North Brooklyn Pipeline with blockades and protests. And actions against Line 3 are heating up. On December 14th, 22 water protectors were arrested for blockading construction of the Line 3 drill pad under the Mississippi River, while a tree sitter blocked construction for over 10 days. Various blockades and lockdowns have also taken place against pipeline construction. Meanwhile, in so-called Minneapolis, people have protested outside of banks which are financing the project. In Bloomington, Indiana, over 100 people gathered against police harassment and attacks on the poor and houseless, and actions by tenant unions recently took place in D.C. and Oakland, California. Meanwhile, in Brooklyn, New York, a rally demanding the extension of existing eviction moratoriums was attacked violently by the police. And in so-called Toronto, tenant actions continue against evictions in the midst of the growing pandemic. Tenants have continued to hold demonstrations against evictions at corporate offices and against landlords. If you're looking to show solidarity this holiday season, here's some people and projects that need it. Anarchist prisoner Eric King's trial has been pushed back to next spring, so be sure to send him some letters. Anti-fascists arrested in so-called Sacramento, California last weekend need support, so check our show notes for ways to donate. The Indigenous Anarchist Federation has new patches for sale to support their project. Woodbine, an autonomous anti-capitalist space in Brooklyn, is looking to upgrade to a larger venue. And lastly, the Everett Free Grocery Program is fundraising for a new year, and you can check our show notes for ways to support and help all of these projects. Speaking of ways to support, if you value what's going down as a revolutionary autonomous media resource in times of crisis and you have the means, please help us continue and grow into 2021. You can help us greatly by going to itsgoingdown.org/shop and giving us a one-time donation or signing up to donate monthly, and you can also donate through Bitcoin. Tell a friend about It's Going Down, follow our RSS feed, and listen to us on the radio, and also check us out on Twitter, Instagram, and Mastodon. Remember, It's Going Down is part of the Channel Zero Anarchist Podcast Network, so if you enjoy this show, there's lots of other ones to check out. As always, enjoy the interviews and the discussions, and we will see you soon.
I'm William X. Nietzsche. I'm the eldest son of William and Julie Kinney, who are the elders at the Red House, who own the Red House. I'm also the one that has been handling all the litigation and arbitration in this case, so I'm familiar with most of the legal facts.
Well, right off the bat, you know, I just wanted to ask you, you know, it's been a couple of days now. This whole thing has been going on, obviously, for a long time. I'm just curious, you know, in your head, based on all the media stuff that you've seen, what are some things that you think the media is getting wrong or that you want to clarify just right off the bat?
Yeah, I would say one of the main things to address is how we've been getting the false coverage that we're some sort of violent group with, you know, web stockpiles of weapons, because all that stuff is, you know, fake news. It's not, that's, none of that stuff has been verified. So it seems as though they're using that to give us some type of bad, you know, bad rep, when really we're just a, all is regular community neighbors coming together in a sense of desperation, seeing the countdown on the moratoriums and seeing how elders of the community were treated, being removed at gunpoint.
Yeah, you mentioned at gunpoint and also just being kind of branded as violent. I'm just curious. I know, you know, there's been now in the past couple of months, there's been at least two attempted evictions. And the police have, you know, like, torn the doors down, come inside with guns drawn. Can you talk about those interactions with law enforcement in the past couple months?
A deep conversation to have in terms of how atrocious that the acts have been, the demeanor, the taunting by the officers of my mother and father. And they do this with impunity, as if they can't be held accountable. But the aggressiveness is, it's not anything. They're supposed to be peace officers and they're too much force, they're too militarized. That's how they seem to, you know, have this power, this power complex, and coming in with those assault rifles and stuff and barking orders and treating us, you know, me and my brother were treated like animals, being thrown in these cold, you know, holding cells, like cages with no, you know, no blanket to stay warm. And these are, you know, humiliating tactics used by law enforcement here in Portland, Oregon. It's been pretty abusive, the totalitarian already, my encounters with law enforcement here in Portland, Oregon.
You mentioned that the moratorium is going to end soon unless something's done to extend it. And also, Oregon is in the midst of a COVID just upsurge right now. I think on Monday, right before, you know, news kind of centered on you all at the Red House, it reached 36 deaths in Oregon in the state, and that's like the most it's been since the pandemic began. I'm just curious if you can speak on both the threat of COVID-19 and also the end of the moratorium, what that would mean for just everyday people in
Portland and beyond across the state if that was to happen. Do you feel like the militarized response, as you were saying, by the police is almost sending a message to the rest of working and poor people in Portland that saying, like, look, like if you're thinking about fighting your eviction, this is what we have in store for you?
I mean, that's history, right? History always shows that when the people rise up, police carry out elected officials' dirty work and then brutalize the people. I mean, we're getting to a different point. We're getting to a different level. And it's time for us to level up as people and realize that all folks deserve to be housed, that housing is a human right, that black and brown folks have been displaced enough, that black folks need reparations, that indigenous folks need sovereignty.
My perspective on that is that, yes, these colonial tactics have been used dating all the way back to the Willie Lynch tactics used to publicly humiliate the slave to make all the other slaves scared from, you know, engaging in the same type of behavior. So I am familiar with some of those political science tactics that are used to basically quell or make the fear out there to not rebel or do anything against the system, or else we'll come flexing 10 times stronger with our guns.
Can you talk about how the North Portland neighborhood where you all are at has changed due to gentrification? For those that are kind of outside the area and may not know, can you just talk a little bit about that history?
I've been looking closely at, you know, why this has taken place and how, and I've been able to pinpoint that the school-to-prison pipeline that was uncovered and a lot of the research here is something I survived and experienced, and seeing my whole generation of schoolmates and classmates inside the prison system. And a lot of those African American families were put into distressed situations because they were attacking the children, and that would cause the homeowners, the mothers and fathers, to face financial hardships, such as getting loans like my mother and father did, or becoming, you know, drug dependent and, you know, losing their homes that way. That was a lot of the tactics used. And the criminalization of our public school system, the effects of the crack epidemic and the CIA placements of those particular drugs in the African-American communities to desecrate the hubs of the African-American communities across the United States of America. So I would say that, yeah, they've used these schemes to displace over 10,000 African-American families once located in the northeast of the exodus of all the African American families to either the funeral home or a prison cell or to Gresham.
I wanted to turn now and talk about the neighborhood in general and just the level of support for what's going on at the Red House. I'm just curious now that the defense of the eviction is on, what are people in the general area that are impacted by the blockade? What are they saying?
I've been getting a lot of neighborly and community support. And like I said, a lot of these are concerned neighbors, whether it be concerns over their being backdated in payments or, concerns of, you know, high rise being built, another high rise being built in the Mississippi district that, you know, will sit vacant. So they're concerned about, you know, what is to come into the Mississippi district. And yeah, I just, I see it being a organic hub of community members coming together to confront this unjust situation.
Can you talk a little bit about that relationship, the people that have shown up that are on the grounds now that are helping to defend the home from the eviction? I know people have been out there since September building and organizing. Can you talk about how those relationships kind of came together?
Yeah, once September 9th, that's when it just naturally started growing into a community service hub, to say the least, for the houseless community in particular, as we were basically in between being homeless or houseless and trying to hold on to our home. So we became a hub for a lot of the houseless community to come and have a safe place to set up a tent and safe place to get warm and get clothing and food.
Well, I'm curious, you know, where do you see things going in the coming days? Do y'all have a plan, or is it just kind of day by day? What do you see happening?
So yeah, where we're at now, we're waiting on waiting to hear back from Ted Willer's office for a public written apology to the Kenny family, and having that same statement verified by the Portland Police Chief. And we're waiting on a public written statement as we speak. And we've been talking negotiations of pulling back some of the barriers and going back to how we had it set up before. And also getting a confirmation that we can now proceed with talks of negotiations without threat of being removed again.
Well, you mentioned some of your neighbors are behind on their payments and, you know, underwater and all that stuff. For those that are listening that are facing a similar situation in their housing, whether they're, you know, facing foreclosure or being evicted if they're renting, what advice from this whole experience would you give them?
One of my pieces of advice would be to we have to reach out to our elected representatives. And maybe look at forming an alliance of, homeowners and tenants to prepare for systematic attacks. That's one proactive measure that could be taken to confront these things, along with, I intend on establishing a hub for legal rights training on how to just do some of the basic stuff so that you can, you know, ward off an attack such as this, because I can now educate and give my wisdom on how I've been able to hold off this systematic attack for the last 2 years by standing on my rights.
I'm just curious if you want to say anything else about just kind of the dynamic, struggle that's evolved in the streets around the Red House, and just kind of your feelings on that. I mean, obviously I haven't been there myself, but looking at the photos, it seems very impressive, and people are really holding it down. I'm just curious, your thoughts when you kind of like see just the, literally like hundreds of people are showing up to support the home and just people defending against the eviction. Your thoughts on that?
I actually see this as a wake-up call for, a lot of the issues going on in the world today and how we've been divided and conquered as, neighbors and community members. This kind of has knocked off that callous feeling between, diverse families to come together and stand in solidarity against this type of systematic oppression. So it is, I think, an example for the rest of the world to see how a diverse, community can come together and combat these issues together without any, color blindness to race and things of that nature.
Well, thanks so much for talking with us. I guess my last question is, as we kind of enter this, very scary period with moratoriums ending and also just the pandemic continuing to rage, do you think we'll see more actions like this where people are just saying like, no, we're not going to leave our homes?
Yeah, I think that we're pioneering sound strategies to combat these types of things, such as the eviction blockade that we have. Yes, it's been a success thus far. No one has got hurt. It's been peaceful. We got scuffled up in these false arrests, but yeah, we're still on the run.
Well, anything else you want to say?
I would, I wanted to let people know that me and my brother Philo are music artists, and that we've been, a voice for the oppression for a long time through our music, and that can be previewed, some of our music, at citizen2music.com, and that's CITIZENPOOMUSIC.com. And of course, visit redhouseonmississippi.com for some of the specifics about what's going on at the Red House and to stay up to date.
Well, hey, thanks so much for talking with us. Best of luck to you, and thanks again for taking time to speak with us.
Yeah, thank you. I appreciate it, and I'm glad we're all coming together on this thing.
I'm Sarah. I'm based in Hamilton, Ontario, Canada. I've been working on the Certain Days Freedom for Political Prisoners calendar for coming on 20 years now.
And I'm Josh in Baltimore. I've been working with the Certain Days Collective for about, I guess, 5 years now.
That's why it got more efficient. I get it.
So what's changed with Certain Days since the last time we talked last year? I know we were talking a little bit about the impact of the pandemic, but any big changes, anything that you want to go over?
Well, I'd say it's been it's been a challenging year, as it has been for everyone. We worked really hard to get the calendar out this year, a little later than usual, but still like a beautiful calendar and packed with information. So we're really proud of it. We've got artists and authors on both sides of the walls, and it was actually our 20th edition this year. So we're just super grateful for everybody that made it possible during these pretty unusual times. including our new design team, mostly based in Canada, and all the people that contributed. It's just, it's been kind of amazing to see that it's still possible in these times. So, I don't know if anything has like changed in a big way, Josh. You could jump in too, but I feel like our distributors and like, the folks that are supporting us, we've relied on them a lot this year. You know, Burning Books in the US in Buffalo, Chris Flebereb in Montreal, Canada. We've got active distribution in the UK. Everybody just worked with us to get copies out to everyone on a pretty tight timeline. And, you know, knowing that we're looking back at a generation of support through the bars, that was our theme this year. Just to see it kind of all come, you know, full circle and just see how much support we have and how many great pieces we got was pretty awesome.
Yeah. Yeah. I think you said it beautifully, Sarah. I would just add the, I guess maybe not over the last few months, but over the last few years, our founding members, two of whom got out, Herman Bell and Seth Hayes, and we're almost coming up on the 1 year anniversary of Seth's death right before the holidays here, and also David Gilbert, who's still in prison, but has a pretty strong clemency campaign going on right now.
You were talking about how important it is, all these distribution projects. I'm curious, like, are you seeing that they're hurting right now, either in terms of the pandemic? And also because, I mean, a lot of people would argue that print is dying. I'm just curious, like, does doing this project make you feel the opposite, that, like, print is still, like, a very viable thing to contribute?
You know what's amazing? This year is probably going better than we expected. And every year I kind of wait for somebody to say, hey, nobody wants a wall calendar anymore, go away. But every year we've got support, and this year probably more than ever. And I don't know if it's because people have really committed to like supporting smaller projects. You know, there's been a lot of, you know, awareness and passion building for social justice in different ways. And so I don't know if it's that. I don't know. It's people are home and they want something to learn from or what it is, but we thought that we'd be struggling more, and I think some of our distributors have told us the same thing, that they are actually thriving. And I think people just have a thirst for building a better world, you know, more than ever, probably. Honestly, many, many years ago, I was a journalist, and all of the papers I was working for were starting to go out of business. And so I feel like at that time I was like, oh boy, getting to digital, that's it. And I still love all the things that we can do online to reach people, but it's been amazing. And of course, I mean, it goes without saying, but I will say it, a lot of our audience and the people that we're trying to raise the voices of are people that don't have access to anything except print. So, I mean, we have to keep it alive.
The last time we talked about the large amount of aging political prisoners who are being let out on compassionate release. Is this something that's still happening? You mentioned David Gilbert's clemency campaign. Let's kind of check in about like where that stuff is at.
Sure. Yeah, there's actually quite a few of them. David Gilbert, one of our founding collective members, he's been in prison for 39 years now, since 1980-81. He's fighting for clemency with Cuomo right now. Hopefully it's successful. If not, he doesn't come up for parole until 2056. He'll be over 100 years old, so that's basically a death sentence. But in addition to David, there's Ed Poindexter of the Nebraska 2, who is also in his mid 70s. Dr. Matula Shakur, who is also facing cancer right now, has a clemency campaign going on, and also Russell Maroon Schultz. Both Matulu and Russell Schultz recently contracted COVID-19. In addition, there's also Leonard Peltier, Mumi Abu-Jamal. Sundiata Okoli was recently denied parole. He's in his mid-80s at this point. There's plenty of others, especially with COVID right now. Jamil Al-Amin, several of the Kings Bay Plowshare 7 are really elderly. So it's a really trying time right now. A lot of people need a lot of support.
And I would say if you don't know these cases, you can find out on the online more about them. New York ABC has like a great website with a lot of updates, and there's others as well. Just like, we don't expect everybody to have these as household names, although they should be. So if you hear anything and you want to know more about it, like, that's a great way to start finding out.
Absolutely. Yeah, you can follow us on social media, too.
Yeah, I was going to say, if for some reason you don't read every month Prison Break on It's Going Down, that's the column that people at certain days write, and it includes updates on everything from who's getting transferred to what prison to who has a crowdfunding campaign to who's getting released to news to everything else in between. So that's a great way to stay up and learn about everything that's going on in terms of political prisoners and prisoners of war support. So I encourage people, check that column out. Just put one out for December, and you can always go to the column tab on It's Going Down to read past issues.
And that's been awesome for us, that space, because, you know, as you can imagine, it's not easy to keep something current throughout 12 months. We print the thing in August, September-ish, and then, you know, it goes up on your wall in January. There's not much you're getting from us that is, like, new news at that point. So this has been, I think, awesome. And Josh has done great work on that.
So there's been a fair amount of prisoners that have been released recently, especially anarchist prisoners. Can you talk about some of them and how are people supporting them being released back into society?
Sure. Yeah, there have been quite a few recently. In the last, I guess, 2 or 3 months, there's been Red Fonfalis from the Standing Rock protests, David Campbell, and Antifa or anarchist from New York City. Jay Chase from the NATO 3 was recently released, as was Jeremy Hammond, the hacktivist to a halfway house. In addition, Jaleel Muntakim, a former Black Panther and Black Liberation Army soldier, was released after 50 years in prison. And he's actually was rearrested for trying to vote for signing a voter registration form, and is facing prison yet again. So I think that kind of highlights the ongoing struggle that people face once they get out.
How much time is he, this is the first time hearing about this. How much time is he facing right now for that?
I'm not sure of the time he's facing. Right now I think there's a couple charges. It's in preliminary stages. There's a few links in the new Prison Break that you can read more at.
Just for filling out the form?
Yeah, when he got out, he had a lot of forms. You know, after 50 years inside, he's got no ID, no insurance, nothing like that. And he had a stack of forms to fill out, one of which I believe was a voter registration form. He filled that out, and in New York State, ex-felons or formerly those formerly in prison cannot vote. So, yeah.
What a country.
Exactly.
What are some major challenges that political prisoners face when they're coming home, besides, of course, filling out the wrong form and then being sent back to prison?
Well, I'd say, once anybody's been released, especially at the amount of time that some of them have spent, you know, it's a struggle. They face more challenges getting settled. So this is part of why, it's so important to do fundraisers and to make sure that they have some material support when they're being released. They need to get set up in new places and get on their feet again as they're getting back out with their loved ones in their community. For example, our former editor, Seth Hayes, who Josh mentioned before, he had a lot of trouble getting housing that was a good fit for his physical needs. Did not have support from his parole team, you know, on many things that he needed that you would have imagined would be pretty practical. So, I would say that, you know, everybody's teams are working on different things and every case is different. Everybody needs different support. But the main point is that they need massive support when they get out. And, no matter, who we're talking about, I'm sure that, you know, they appreciate the support that they're getting. We've tried really hard to contribute to those funds as much as we can with the calendar. And that's one of the nice things about the calendar is that it's a fundraiser as well.
So there's been a lot of arrests since the start of the George Floyd rebellion. For those listening, you all are very much surrounded by the work of supporting people facing repression. What are some things that people supporting those facing serious charges should keep in mind as we kind of like gear up for a lot of long-term support?
Yeah, I mean, it's very important right now. I guess really the most important thing for me is to come at it as a working with people who have been arrested, not like doing charity on behalf of them. You need to figure out what they want. Every person is going to be different. You're trying to do solidarity with them and let them take leadership. So, I mean, you're talking to people that have had things taken away from them in terms of their ability to communicate and their ability to do the work they're doing. So, you know, how can you help support that without taking that agency away from them, I think is super important. So, you know, figure out the lines of communication, figure out how you can help them with what they need, and then also how they want to still be involved, you know, bringing their voice into the struggles that are happening day to day. Josh, I'm sure you have some thoughts around that one too.
Yeah, absolutely. like you said, just determining and finding out what and in what ways you're capable of contributing is really key. There's immediate needs for people that have, you know, that have just been arrested and are facing charges. But then again, there's also long-term, you know, legal needs, like we've seen with Jaleel and people, you know, after 50 years inside, it's a very long struggle. So, you know, people need help at every stage.
So let's talk about the 2021 calendar. What can people expect to see? What's the theme this year? What can we expect for some of the artwork and all the goodies?
Yeah, so we're really happy with this 20th. It's our 20th edition. The theme is a generation of support through the bars, and we're really just kind of looking back at the last 20 years. The artwork and the essays are really amazing this year. We've got so many really great contributors. I'm just going to go ahead and list some of them. Political prisoners. We've got David Gilbert, Veranza Bowers, David Campbell, Eric King, Jan Lahman, Tom Manning. We've got Laura Whitehorn, Linda Evans, and Susan Rosenberg, as well as the Notchley. We've got so many more really amazing essays and artists.
Yeah, I was really inspired by a lot of the contributors this year. And then some of it is a retrospective. We've printed a couple of pieces that were older calendar pieces that we just loved. So, you know, if this is your first time picking up the calendar, it's a pretty cool way to see what we've been working on all these years and all the things that other people involved in the calendar have created over the years. You know, every single month you're going to see a different piece of art and a different article that hopes to inspire us. We say, you know, it's a generation of support through the bars, but it's across borders. It's across different struggles. It's across different groups of people. And, you know, just to see all of it pulled together like that, I'm pumped. You can hear I'm pumped.
Yeah, it's really beautiful. And one of our fellow collective members likes to refer to the calendar as, you know, a Trojan horse, because it's not just a calendar. There's so much more. There's artwork, there's essays and history. And throughout each month, there's dates, you know, like commemorative radical dates. So there's a lot more to it than it appears at first.
Seems like an excellent holiday gift, perhaps. So if you're going to pick one up, where can people go to buy one?
Yes, it is an excellent holiday gift. You can go to our website, certaindays.org. You can go in the U.S. to Burning Books, which is burningbooks.com. And in Canada, you can go to Kerspleb-a-Deb, which is leftwingbooks.net. You can also order calendars for those inside. They're $8 to send one inside to a loved one, $15 each on the outside, or they're also a fundraiser, so you can buy 10 for $100 and make $50 for your group or organization.
Awesome. So tablers, keep that in mind. You know, one thing I wanted to ask, with the new administration coming in, does that present any opportunities at all for people getting out, in terms of just the Trump administration going away? Does that create any sort of space?
You know, I'd like to say there's some sort of hope, but instead of electing a fascist, we elected the guy who wrote the crime bill and his super cop sidekick. So I'm doubtful, but hopeful nonetheless. How about you, Sarah?
Yeah, I got no comment on that one.
No, I mean, you're totally right. It's totally real.
I think that no matter what is happening, we're always working under whatever conditions to try and, fight for the freedom of these political prisoners. And I mean, we're abolitionists. We want this system not to exist at all. We want prisons not to exist. That's not something that's changing anytime soon, but something that I think that we will continue to try and build, with this project and other things in our lives too.
Well, just as kind of a maybe more positive long-term question, with the recent uprising, do you feel that there's a kind of a more wind in the sails, or perhaps maybe newer or younger people talking about political prisoners than before they weren't?
Absolutely. Yeah, I think so. I think we're, since the murder of George Floyd, there have been a lot of young people arrested from New York City to Philadelphia to Seattle for basically attacks against the police. Whether or not they did that or not, they are facing years and years, if not life in prison. So they need support. But yes, I do think that there are younger people picking up calendars, picking up, books and getting more involved.
I think these moments too, are turning points for our movements. Like, I became involved in activism in, I guess, what you would have think, the early kind of anti-globalization days. That was incredibly invigorating to see that people were standing up to try and protect, other human beings. And so, I hope that is inspirational, and I hope that we can bring these voices into that. That's one of the things that I've always thought was amazing about the calendar, is we don't just talk about prison struggles. We talk about, global struggles and try and bring prisoners' voices into them as well. So, I hope that we can be part of that.
Are there big projects that you're looking forward with certain days that maybe are on the horizon that you're feeling like you're working towards?
Every year we're able to contribute more to the group that we're fundraising for. And that's what keeps me going. There are times that this is challenging, and there are times that you wonder, if this project is just going to keep going. And to me, the fact that we successfully raise thousands of dollars for grassroots groups, whatever it is, whatever's needed. And we do have the groups that we select, every year. And then we have the groups that, we kind of reserve funds for, depending on what's happening in the movement. So that gives us some flexibility. Josh, maybe you can do a better job of saying the actual groups.
But you're absolutely right. Thinking back 20 years ago, I wasn't involved, but the calendar, I believe, made a few thousand dollars from a few hundred calendars. And was able, to provide support. But now we're selling thousands and thousands of calendars and raising thousands and thousands of dollars that helps people and helps their legal battles and their legal struggles. In the past, we've been able to support groups like Women's Wellness Within in Canada, Amistad Law Project in Pittsburgh, I believe, Civil Liberties Defense Center out in Eugene, Rosenberg Fund for Children in New York, and so many other groups like the Unistoten Camp, For Struggle Mag, Solidarity Across Borders. And every year we always contribute to Release Aging People in Prison. That's RAP in New York, working to get the elderly out of prison. And Adamir, which is a Palestinian prisoner support group. So yeah, we're so pleased, and that is really what keeps us going, is knowing that all the work we put into it provides concrete support to those who need it most.
Awesome. Well, anything else you all want to talk about or go over?
I will just do a shout out for Eric King. He's a friend. I'm on the support crew, and we just found out that he's allowed to receive mail. He hasn't been allowed to get mail from anyone besides his mom or his wife since, I believe, April. He's been in lockdown. He recently contracted COVID-19, and he can use any support, any love you can send. So please mail him. Please check out his website and offer what you can.
One last question I wanted to ask is that, mentioned Eric King has contracted COVID-19. Several other political prisoners. I mean, if you go back and actually read the column Prison Break for December, I mean, it's pretty harrowing how many people have contracted it. I'm just curious, you know, what your thoughts are just watching people contract the virus while they're locked up inside. What does that say?
It's scary as hell right now with so many political prisoners being up in years. Julio Montequim contracted it several months ago. He before he got out when he was inside. Now we've got Maroon Schotz, Mutula Shakur. It's crazy. Yeah, Eric King, so many of them. And Jeremy Hammond as well.
I mean, the whole system is just not protecting anyone who's in prison, right? It's absolutely horrible. The conditions that people are in and the measures they're taking are not enough. So, I mean, it's the reason you keep going. It can be really discouraging because it seems like such a big challenge ahead of us. But you know what? The more people learn what's happening and stand up against it and make phone calls and write letters and do all the actions that are happening, to try and stop this abuse, I think the better. So hopefully we'll inspire some of that. And, you know, we really thank everybody who's contributing to it in every single way.
Please check out Prison Break, share it online. It's a great one-stop kind of hub for information on political prisoners and prisoners of war. Check it out. And if you can, get a copy of the Certain Days calendar.
Eleanor Goldfield. I'm a creative radical, journalist and a filmmaker. And I've appreciated the work that It's Going Down has done for quite some time. So it's really rad to be here with you.
And you mentioned before we started recording that you are involved in the music industry. And I know that you have a show that's come out for a long time that's on Free Speech TV. How did you make that transition?
Yeah, so the show is no longer on Free Speech TV, but it was for 5 years. Basically, I made that transition it was kind of like a default transition. I was already doing journalism work inside the music industry, and then around Occupy, that shifted to doing journalism about political, socio-political issues and anti-capitalist issues. And then the band just kept hitting a wall in terms of both because I was being asked to weigh my morals against my dreams, asked to get a boob job, asked to wear fishnets on stage, write some love songs, stop talking politics, that sort of thing. And also just because I was kind of tired of the industry. I worked as a tech in recording studios and I wasn't really that passionate about fixing consoles, to be honest. And so I kind of shifted and then started focusing more and more on the journalism side of things and really trying to get to the stories that exist behind corporate media and behind the headlines there, whether that means going to a place to actually talk to the people who are affected or really trying to dig beyond the propaganda that's put out by the state and their mouthpieces of corporate media. So, it was kind of a slow but natural transition that was hurried along, I guess, by my exasperation with the music industry.
Oh, wow, that's really fascinating. What was your experience like with Free Speech TV?
There's a lot of work that Free Speech TV does that's great. I think that I don't want to get like too far into the weeds on this, but I will say that Free Speech TV does walk a line in terms of what they're willing to show and what they're willing to promote. And although my show did really well, they were not really interested in promoting it or interested in really working with me beyond a certain point. I was a little bit too radical for them. So we parted ways. I still appreciate a lot of the work they do, but it just wasn't a good fit for me.
Huh, that's interesting. I remember 10 years ago, they would like fill like 10-minute holes in their programming with like a cartoon version of the Communist Manifesto. So.
I miss those days.
I guess it's changed a little bit. So tell us about the film that you've worked on and now it's out in the world. You were saying it's going before all these different film festivals, winning all this awards. It's called The Hard Road of Hope. So what drove you to make this film, and what was the inspiration behind it? And just tell us a little bit about it.
For sure. Yeah. So basically I was, as I mentioned, like one of the things that was important or that is important to me as a journalist is to actually go, if I can, to the places where the stories are happening so that I'm not getting it through like this, raggedy game of telephone. And, you know, I'm privileged to be able to do that. I have, you know, some donations that come from Patreon and the like, but, so the plan was to go to West Virginia, myself and a couple of other journalists, one of them being, the Indigenous journalist Jen Dierenwater, who wanted to go there for a couple of reasons, but, mostly because it's her ancestral homelands. She's Cherokee and she wanted to see that what's going on there through the Indigenous lens that she works through. And I also wanted to go. Environmental work has been kind of the probably what I've worked on the most since I started doing organizing work back before the second Iraq War. So it was really something that I was interested in doing. And I thought at the beginning I was like, oh great, well I'll go down there, you know, we'll talk to some folks, we'll share their stories, and then I can write some articles. I can, you know, put it as part of a segment on Free Speech TV. And I realized that I actually wanted to dig deeper into these stories and in a way that could not be shared in an article or a 30-minute segment. And I thought, well, I think that there's something that's called a film that can actually encapsulate this a little bit further. So I just decided that I would make a documentary. Something that I hadn't done before, but something that I felt was necessary to do right by the folks that had shared their stories with me. So it kind of happened organically that way, and before I knew it, I had a film. It's about it's kind of about West Virginia, but it also holds up a mirror to the rest of the United States and also outside of you know, these borders, not just in the sense that it has a long history of oppression at the hands of corporate greed and industry, but also in terms of the radical resistance and the radical fights that have taken place there, which is something that echoes throughout the so-called United States. And I wanted to highlight that. And what's interesting is that I've had folks who have seen the movie, you know, California, Colorado, Ohio, that say, hey, I recognize this story. And at a time when, you know, the history of the United States has been very good at killing the labor rights movement. And at a time when we start to see, you know, that movement percolating again, whether that be teacher strikes or folks working to unionize, it is something that I felt was important to highlight that, oh, we have this radical past. It's just that it's been really well buried. Both in terms of, you know, our official education in schools, but also our cultural education. So I think that that felt really important to highlight that labor rights history, and also the sort of the insidious nature of these industries, whether that be coal, which is dying, or fracking, which is on the rise, particularly in central and, you know, towards the north of West Virginia. So I wanted to highlight that transition, because it's something that I feel like has kind of passed under the radar. People just, even in the environmental, spaces, folks are saying, oh, coal is dying. This is great. We can kind of lean back. But, you know, fracking is on the rise. And while it doesn't look like mountaintop removal, it is no less destructive and oppressive.
In the description of the film, you write, once the home to the rise of the reign of King Coal, West Virginia is now in the crosshairs of a transition of power from coal to gas, which you mentioned. Explain how this is so. I think that's really fascinating.
Sure. So I'll start with a quote from one of the folks that I spoke to, a former coal miner, who said that, you know, it's like just scraping the last of the peanut butter from the peanut butter jar. You're desperately trying to get at those last coal deposits. And that's what mountaintop removal is. It's essentially like fracking in the sense that you've already gotten to the stuff that's easy to get to. Now you're just blasting the entire mountain apart to get to the coal seams within. And so basically, you know, despite the best efforts, and not just of Trump, Obama, too, tried to bolster the coal industry and put up, you know, quote unquote regulations that weren't regulations. For instance, he had a regulation that said that you could only leave a coal slurry, which is the, you know, the disgusting toxic sludge that comes after you wash coal. You can only dump that into an unlined earthen dam and leave it there for 3 years. And then you have to clean it up. Well, because we're not on the surface of the moon, there's actual changes that happen over the course of 3 years on the surface. And that coal slurry then leaks into the water and or into the ground, affecting, of course, the ecosystems beneath the ground. So after 3 years, there's nothing really to clean up anyway. But Obama got to say, oh, I've regulated the coal industry, which he hadn't. And, you know, even Trump, you know, saying that we're going to bring coal back. Well, there's nothing to bring back. You've mined the majority of it. So even friends of coal in high places can't save coal. There's nothing, you know, it's a finite resource. So this has really precipitated the rise of fracking and this sort of transition being that, oh, hey, you know, now the need for electricity has to come from fracking, right? So if you the signs that used to say if you like having your lights on, you like coal, now say if you like having your lights on, you like gas and oil in the fracking industry. And so it's kind of like this seamless transition, and the playbook that that big coal used for, you know, for a century or more is now transitioning to fracking. You know, these arguments that, oh, without us, you wouldn't have jobs. Without us, you wouldn't have energy. And by the way, it's clean. You know, clean. The idea of clean coal is now the idea of clean gas. And, oh, look, we've got these small footprints. There's just this little tiny well, and it just puts down this little pipe to get the oil and gas, and it's no big deal. There's nothing bad that's going to happen. You know, meanwhile, people are having you know, their water poisoned. They've got respiratory issues. You know, land, water, and air are being poisoned, but it doesn't look as bad as a giant coal mine. So this seamless transition is you know, underway in West Virginia. And it's really just highlighting how tight not only these industries are with each other, but with the governments that are in place. Because of course, all of these horrors that are being played out, not just on the nature there and the land, but the people as well, they all have permits for these things. And the people that try to rise up and, you know, and talk to the politicians about it are shut out and shut down.
How does the opioid crisis factor into kind of the human aspect of what's happening in coal country in Appalachia?
Yeah, so West Virginia holds the uncoveted first place in terms of the opioid crisis. One out of every 400 people in West Virginia has died due to the opioid epidemic. And to give people an idea of what that looks like in terms of population, West Virginia has fewer people than the borough of Brooklyn in New York City. It's also the second most rural state in the nation, and the third poorest. So when you bring these factors together and you look at the triggers for addiction, being trauma, stress, isolation, not just physical isolation, but mental and emotional isolation. And then on top of that, you have industries that are very physically demanding. You know, coal miners and those who work in the dirty energy sector are oftentimes dealing with pain, whether that be their joints or actual, like black lung or something like that. So when you have these intersection of physical pain and then the emotional and mental pain of the systems that they live in, you have this perfect storm or this perfect stage for the opioid crisis to play out on. And that's exactly what we've seen in West Virginia. And you know, you've got an entire generation that's really disappearing. You have grandparents taking care of their grandkids because their children are not available, either because they've died because of the opioid crisis or because they're, you know, in rehab or trying to claw their way back from this opioid epidemic. Which is just another example, right, of corporate greed at play. You know, the Sackler family that's behind the rise of the opioid epidemic is going to, you know, live long and prosper, and they have the blood of hundreds of thousands on their hands. And there's really no help for these people in places like West Virginia, whose healthcare system was abhorrent before the opioid crisis. You know, obviously now continuing in the pandemic. People don't have access to basic things like, dental care or eye care or, preventative medicine like that. So it's really been an incredible weight on top of the issues that folks in West Virginia were already dealing with. One person said to me, like, it seemed like the perfect answer to everyone's problems. Like, oh, I'm in pain, but I can't quit my job. Oh, here's this magical little pill that's going to make it all better. Now that I'm addicted, I can't quit. Because if I quit, then I don't get my medical care anymore because it's tied to my job. So I better stick with my job, which will perpetuate the pain, which will perpetuate the need for the opioids. So it's this really self-serving cycle that just continues to really break communities and break the people in West Virginia.
Why has Trump, do you think, gained such a following there? And how does this speak to the failure of neoliberalism in the Democratic Party?
Yeah, I'm reminded of a quote by Ajamu Baraka from Black Alliance for Peace, who said, "I hate to break it to you folks, but neoliberalism is fascism." And I think that, you know, that really just speaks to the course of neoliberalism. You know, Trump doesn't exist in a vacuum. The system that created a space for Trump is a neoliberal system that has no problem with Trump. You know, the Democrats obviously have no problem with Trump. Otherwise, they wouldn't have tried so hard to beat back someone like Sanders, who really isn't that left anyway. You know, in many European nations, he would be seen as a centrist, including Sweden, where I'm from, which is by no means a socialist paradise. So I think in terms of, you know, Trump, what folks in West Virginia made clear to me was that they've been programmed perfectly for Trump. And that really is this idea, this deep propagandization that's been happening over the course of the past few generations that went from a deep respect for labor movements to now what it is, which is taking pride in their own oppression. And this idea that, you know, pick yourself up by your bootstraps, be a real American, you know, this type of really toxic masculinity and toxic capitalist colonialist mentality. And really what it is it's a way to try and put a salve on the pain that folks are feeling, right? This idea that why do I have it so bad? Why do I have, you know, why is my life so difficult? It shouldn't be, well, here's the answer to your problems. You know, Trump says it's the Mexicans. Trump says it's the Chinese or whatever. There's an easy scapegoat, right? It's always easier to kick down than to punch up. And that's something that really, again, speaks to this deep programming that has happened over the course of the past few generations. One of the primary ones in coal country is the advent of the organization Friends of Coal, which was created by Big Coal and the Chamber of Commerce to basically pedestal the coal industry. And instead of, as one of the coal miners pointed or former coal miners pointed out to me, he said, really, what you need is the Friends of Coal Miners, who are looking to ensure that coal miners have that there's regulation, that we can have a just transition to renewable energy, for instance. But Friends of Coal is really just friends of the coal barons. And that's exactly the point, to make people have this pride in their own oppression, which, really aligns with these neoliberal policies, the neoliberal policies of austerity. And, oh, if you're hurting, it's because you're not working hard enough. Meanwhile, people, the coal barons are eating off of golden plates and erasing people's history, so that, as Wilma Steele, who's part of the Mine Wars Museum there, said that if you burn someone's house to the ground, they'll rebuild. But if you take away their history, they don't know who they are. And that's exactly what's happened there, is that they've erased this radical history. And so people feel very isolated, even in terms of their timeline. They feel isolated from their past. And so they create this myth that, you know, pedestals the white worker with coal dust on his face, or with, you know, fracking bits on his belt. And, this is the new Americana. This is what we should aspire to. And that has unfortunately taken hold, and which is why it's been so powerful for people from that area to really work and in terms of community organizing to connect people to this radical past and have them understand that no, your enemy is not, BIPOC folks, or your enemy isn't people who want unions or better regulations. Your enemy is the coal barons, just as it always has been. Your enemy is the titans of industry and the neoliberal and or the fascist state that is using you for their own profit.
In the film, what's the role and importance of this radical working class history and all this?
Sure. So I hadn't really thought of it, but you know, something that Terry Steele, who also works with with the Mine Wars Museum and is a former miner, said, it is grassroots organizing to tell your history. And I think that that's super important because, you know, the history, you know, we just had a so-called Thanksgiving here. And, the history that we're taught in schools here in the U.S. is so horrifically whitewashed. And we don't hear about working class history. We don't hear about the radical folks that organized and stood in solidarity with Black, Indigenous folks and fought for human rights. And, you know, one of the things that Wilma Steele pointed out, who also works with the Mine Wars Museum, is that she grew up in Matewan, which is in southern West Virginia on the border of Kentucky. And she said she's been there her whole life, and she was never taught in school about the Matewan Massacre, which precipitated, you know, a lot of mining wars. She was never told about the Battle of Blair Mountain, where Black and white coal miners joined together at the beginning of the 20th century and not only marched together, but took up arms and fired upon coal barons to demand some basic workers' rights. They weren't taught about that, which of course is on purpose, because the idea that Black and white folks could come together and actually shoot at their oppressors is certainly not something that you want to be teaching kids in school, right? that would really rattle the thrones of the system that you're trying to instill and program into these kids. And so, you know, the importance of the working class history vis-a-vis what, you know, folks like the Mine Wars Museum is doing is vital, because the Mine Wars Museum, which again is in Matewan, West Virginia, and folks might be familiar with that name. There was a documentary of the same name, Matewan, that talked about these turn of the century mine wars and labor rights movements. It's incredibly important because it really highlights the fact that, oh, this is part of part of the history of this place and these people here, is to overcome these extreme divisive machinations. You know, people were put on different parts of the coal mine. They were told, oh, don't talk to the Jews because they eat babies or whatever. Don't talk to the black miners, they're, you know, savages or what have you. And they overcame all of that BS and all of that programming and divisive propaganda in order to organize and find solidarity and find that common ground. And again, take up arms and demand some basic workers' rights. And this is why, you know, for instance, they got paid in American money as opposed to company scrip, which if folks are familiar with the song, I sold my soul to the company store. That's where that comes from, because they weren't paid in American money. They were paid with something called company scrip that they could only use at company stores, which basically meant that, you know, the company wasn't losing any money. You know, there was like this really sick system of indentured servitude. They couldn't go anywhere because they didn't have American money to go anywhere else. And, you know, mine workers could start at the tender age of 10. And, you know, these mine wars meant that the winnings of those mine wars meant that kids were no longer allowed to work in mines. And these are things that we take for granted now, right? Well, of course, there isn't a 10-year-old in the mine. That's absurd. But this was, you know, this was life for folks. And one of the folks in the film told me, you know, his grandfather started working in the mines when he was 10. So this is not like ancient history. This is very recent. And the fight against it is very recent. The fight for basic human rights and workers' rights is very recent. And so it's so important to uncover that and dig that up. Because it's one thing to say, oh, well, at one point somewhere else in the world, like there was the Russian Revolution or something. But it's another thing to say, actually, your grandfather fought for this, or there are people that live down the road that even remember what this was like. It is so much more powerful when somebody can connect to it personally. So teaching these histories of these people's specific home place, of this specific, their specific community history, is so powerful and so important because it's been so buried. And it really is a form of radicalism to tell those stories, to tell the stories that have been purposely silenced and buried by the state and by the industries.
Well, I know that, you know, the film obviously talks about mountaintop removal. So what is the state of that movement right now?
They're continuing. You know, mountaintop removal is something that unfortunately is still going. There's one of the groups that I worked with when I was down there is the group Keepers of the Mountain, or Keeper of the Mountains. One of the things that's really powerful that they do is they take you on give tours. I guess they're not doing it at the moment, but they do give tours of a place called Caford Mountain, which was saved by, you know, community organizing and direct action, saved from the coal industry. But from that mountain, you can look out and see a place that was leveled by mountaintop removal. And now you have some grasses growing back, but it's clear that, you know, what was destroyed will never be whole again. And Paul Corbett Brown, who's in the film, and is the current head of, Keeper of the Mountains, makes this very clear. You know, it's like decapitating a person, decapitating a mountain, because a mountain is a living ecosystem. Once you break it, you can like try to grow some grasses and things, but it's not, you can't put that ecosystem back together again. And so with this understanding, Keeper of the Mountains and other organizations, like you mentioned, Earth First and other folks are continuing to work very hard to stop this. And, you know, one of the things that is also pointed out in the film is that, you know, people have to be very active in this fight. You know, it's not enough to just, just write a letter to your member of Congress. You have to actually go to these places, and for those who can, put your body on the line, and for those who can't, support those who are. And you know, there's another example is that there was a another person who's in the film, Chad, is part of a Kanawha Forest Coalition who stopped the construction of a mine in the Kanawha Forest region outside of Charleston, West Virginia. And they stopped it by going there, by always like physically having a presence there, to the point where it just didn't, where they just couldn't get around these people that were in their way. And that's, you know, of course, organizations like Earth First are very familiar with this, you know, whether, you know, everywhere around the world, like right now in Germany, there, the folks are literally standing in the way of a construction of a highway, and have been standing in the way of lignite coal mining in East Germany. So, you know, these are the kind of things that folks around the world understand is how you affect change. You actually have to go out there and do it, because something that's very clear in West Virginia and has been for a long time is that the politicians are deep in the pockets of industry, and knocking on their doors is not going to do anything. It's just going to create, it's like yelling into an anechoic chamber. So yeah, this is, the mountaintop removal is unfortunately still ongoing, because again, it's just trying to get that last bit of peanut butter out of the jar. So that is something that continues to be fought at the same time, trying to build those solidarity networks with the folks that are fighting fracking, in other parts of the state. So yeah, there's a lot still going on with that.
What would you say the role of the recent miner blockades where miners, we actually had the chance to talk to one of the miners that was involved in,
Black Diamond,
yeah. They were involved in the blockades there. Would you say that's had a big impact in the region?
Yeah, absolutely. And there is strong camaraderie and solidarity between folks in West Virginia and Kentucky and Ohio in terms of their shared history of these sort of exploitative industries. And absolutely, I mean, when I was talking to folks, this was a few months, because I started my filming in West Virginia in like late October of 2019. And so it was just that summer, I believe, that they had created that blockade and the trucks and they had blocked the railroad, the train tracks for against the coal company. And this was incredibly powerful to folks. And I know that there was some conversation with former coal miners and I believe some members of the UMWA in West Virginia. And this is, you know, it was great to see, because there was this powerful, it was almost like the echoes of the past, but they had been, you know, obviously like repurposed for this place and time. And, you know, the same thing with the teachers' strike that started in West Virginia. And a lot of people around the country were like, what, West Virginia? That's so bizarre. But really, it's not. If you look at the history of West Virginia, there's a lot of radical workers there who've fought for workers' rights as it's part of their, you know, their history. So there was definitely a lot of solidarity there. And there were some folks who went to visit the blockade that was happening in Kentucky. And, you know, I think moments like these and direct action like these, has a rippling effect. You know, it brings feelings of power to other people to see folks not just fighting, but winning. And really understanding that, yeah, we have the power, you know, it's, we are oppressed because we are, you know, to a certain extent, because we are allowing that to perpetuate. But if we just say no more, there's a lot we can do. And so there's been a lot of talks that have stemmed from that, you know, this feeling that like, okay, what's next? Like, what else are we demanding outside of, you know, back pay and things like that? What about, you know, healthcare? What about like a just transition and things like that? So, yeah, I mean, things like that, it's really hard to even say like how powerful those things can be in terms of how they affect other folks in the same position, in terms of what they think is possible and what they can demand beyond it.
There's also a shot in the trailer that includes a scene from the Yellowfinch tree sit, which is an ongoing battle against resource extraction and the construction of the Mountain Valley Pipeline. What are your thoughts on kind of these current struggles that are playing out right now that are really involving both people that are kind of on the front lines of water protectors or, you know, ecological direct action struggles, and also involving a lot of people that live in these communities.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's incredibly powerful. I've been following the fight against the Mountain Valley Pipeline for years now. And I think, you know, recently they just celebrated the 800th day of the tree sit, which is, you know, phenomenal. It's fantastic. And I think that, you know, this too is highlighting, the radical history of these places that, you know, people in those communities have respond, not everyone, obviously, but, many folks in that region have responded really favorably. And I think that this also, you know, speaks to some intersections that I also highlight in the film. You know, some people, and I've seen this happen too in places like Pennsylvania, where people come to it from like this private property perspective, and then after a while start questioning that as well, and start instead talking about like, oh, well, maybe it's not about private property. Maybe it's really about the, you know, the ecosystems that we're a part of, and also understanding and incorporating like an indigenous decolonizing perspective on that organizing. And I think this really speaks again to like the intersections of issues. You know, nobody lives single issue lives. We all live with these issues. They're all part of our lives in some way. And these fights are a tremendous opportunity to highlight that. And to highlight the important intersections that are part of our system and part of that oppressive system, and how we can learn from folks in different communities and what they can learn from you know, organizers, and this shared, you know, kind of like mutual aid, this shared building of solidarity, this networking, this knowledge share and skill share and things like that. So I think, you know, what has happened with, or what continues to happen with the Yellowfinch blockade and the Mountain Valley Pipeline blockade is incredibly powerful. And just to see, you know, that the sister pipeline, the Atlantic Coast Pipeline, got shot down. And recently, you know, the Line 5 pipeline was shot down by the governor of Michigan. And not because she's some radical environmentalist, but because people would not stop. People would not stop fighting against this and for clean air, clean land, and clean water. So I think it's really powerful to see the ripple effects and the ramifications of actions like what we continue to see at Yellowfinch.
Well, anything else you'd like to add?
The film is available, like the full film is available for people to see via the website. And I mean, in terms of like the themes, I think again, like just the themes that exist across borders, whether that be state borders or nation borders, the idea that the story of West Virginia is not just the story of West Virginia, in fact, is the story of the United States. And I think another one of the things that like really was highlighted to me in doing this work was, you know, I partially grew up in North Carolina, and West Virginia was kind of like the butt end of jokes there, which was, I mean, if you're the butt end of jokes in North Carolina, that's saying something. Because North Carolina is no pinnacle of justice or ecological well-being. And so it was kind of interesting to me to see how that shift happened within myself too, understanding that, oh, West Virginia is the butt end of jokes because people talk about it like it's a throwaway state filled with throwaway people. You know, it's always just a bunch of hillbillies. You know, and like, right wingers, who cares? Oh, it's just a bunch of like coal mines and it's been destroyed. Who cares? But if we're ready to throw away an entire area and, an entire, you know, community of people for those reasons, what part of the United States would you have left? What part of the United States has not been violently decimated by industry? What part of the United States has not been oppressed by the state and by industry? I mean, you wouldn't have anyone left to talk about. So there's that part of it, but also then the power of propagandization, the power of hiding people's history from them, and the importance of highlighting that history, whether that be a radical working class history or even just the formation of West Virginia as a state, these beautiful ideas that West Virginia was founded because they didn't want slaves and, you know, during the Civil War. Well, that's nonsense. There was no problem with, people had no problem with slavery in what was then the western part of Virginia. So West Virginia was founded as a resource colony, you know, and this idea that that it has this sort of like mythological, beautiful, you know, history is just as ridiculous as saying that, you know, the pilgrims and the indigenous peoples of what is now the U.S. got along swimmingly. These are dangerous myths that that prop up a system that is in reality, of course, founded on genocide and slavery and the extreme oppression based on this sort of capitalist colonialist framework. So, yeah, I mean, I think the history of West Virginia and the present of West Virginia is incredibly powerful to look at in terms of the history of the United States at large. And the myths that we hold on to as a nation and the histories, why they're buried and why it's so important to uncover them and dig them up and share them widely. And how that can, you know, serve us as we walk this, you know, hard road of hope, so to speak. How we can build a future based on the past that has been stolen from folks.
Curious if you have any thoughts on how people from outside the region can support grassroots initiatives there.
Yeah, so I'd say the best way is to find folks that are organizing there. Some good places to start are Keeper of the Mountains. That's the grassroots organization that works to combat mountaintop removal. There's also a lot of you know, anti-fracking work going on in the region. And, you know, Frack Tracker has been really helpful in the creation of the film in terms of identifying, fracking infrastructure and, identifying folks that are good to talk to about these issues. Of course, the folks that are fighting the Mountain Valley Pipeline, Appalachians Against Pipelines is a great place, to look, both in, of course, in West Virginia and also Virginia. And I'd say, you know, just supporting those folks that are there working on this. And, you know, just, I think, you know, another thing that Terry Steele pointed out, who's a former coal miner, you know, he said that some environmentalists think that, you know, we don't understand climate change or we don't understand what's going on, and we do. And so I'd say another thing, and this is also coming from somebody who grew up in the South, is that, like, don't talk down to people and don't talk to them like they don't understand what's going on. You know, understand that a lot of those folks that work in the coal industry and the fracking industry do so because their choice is that or not have a job. And understanding that they are also part of this oppressive machine. And not that everybody's just going to be like, oh yes, I understand, and you know, walk off their job. Of course, there are pipeline workers and coal miners and things that are violent and you know, fascist in a lot of ways that want to hurt people that are trying to protect land and water. But I think overwhelmingly the angle at which folks come at should be one of trying to build solidarity as opposed to trying to either talk down to people and tell them what they need to understand, or one of demonizing the folks that work in these industries because they don't have a choice.
So you mentioned that the film can be viewed online. Do you want to talk about where people can go to watch it?
For sure. So the film is up at hardroadofhope.com. And folks can get it there. It's also, I'm doing screenings, both in terms of, organizations that want to use it as an organizing tool, and for educational purposes. So you can buy it online for personal use, but if folks are interested in doing any kind of screening, outside of that, please feel free to reach out to me, and you can do that at the website, hardroadofhope.com. And all the other work that I do, the journalism and the art and things, can be found over at artkillingapathy.com.
This has been the It's Going Down podcast. Check itsgoingdown.org for daily updates, columns, action reports, and news. Go to itsgoingdown.org/shop to support us. And follow us on all social media platforms. IGD, your daily resource for insurgent proletarian life.